That's not how it works. That's not how any of this works.
That's what I keep saying. Hey, good morning and welcome into this edition of The Daily Perspective. May not be morning where you are, but it's morning where I am. And for those of you on Facebook Live, it is morning. For those of you listening via podcast, whatever time or place you may be in, congratulations on your ability to time travel. It is the Wednesday edition of the podcast, and it's the Wednesday before Thanksgiving. So let me kick things off by saying happy Thanksgiving to you. Thanks for being here. I'm glad you're there. Good to have you along for the ride on the bus going down the crazy streets that is just basically life in America today. I hope that you are doing well, that your family is doing well, and that you are looking forward to a good day together tomorrow. And hopefully you are going to remember tomorrow what tomorrow is really about. And it's not about that delicious fried turkey. It's or however you fix it. It's about something else entirely. In fact, we'll wrap today's podcast up with a little reminder about what Thanksgiving really started out to be. Okay? All right. Just remember, that's in the final segment today. Yesterday, wow, what a day that was. I had a really busy day yesterday, some of it unanticipated. Of course, there was doing the podcast, as usual, spending this hour with you, this hour of observation, insight, and absurdity, and also working on the Christmas perspective. In case you've missed out what the Christmas perspective is, it is a daily dose of the full story of Christmas, December 1st through the 24th. This is what I get for multitasking. I cannot multitask. The Christmas perspective, December 1st through the 24th, through Christmas Eve, a day, each day, one chapter from the New Testament book where the Christmas story is found. Starting off with the Christmas story you're all familiar with, where Linus drops his blanket and tells the world about that night in Bethlehem, and then moving forward all the way through the life of Jesus. And it's an important thing. You get through the 24th, you hit that final chapter, and you wake up on Christmas morning, and fresh in your mind is the reason for the day. The entire life, not just the baby Jesus in the manger. And I think that's very important, because one of the things we're seeing nowadays coming from our liberal friends on social media is that condescending little shot from time to time where they tell you, hey, you go ahead and have fun with your friend, the baby Jesus. They refer to Jesus as the baby Jesus, as it's a derogatory thing. Well, that was just the beginning. There's a lot more to the story, and that's what the Christmas perspective is about. You can find that. Actually, there's a link at dailyperspectivepodcast.com, the website for this podcast, dailyperspectivepodcast.com. You can go there and look over on the right-hand side. In that right column, there is a little section for pages. There's the contact page, and then there's the Christmas perspective. You go there, and what you see right now is nada. There's just nothing there but the graphic. But when these episodes start dropping, each daily chapter starts dropping, they're going to stack up on that page, one by one by one. Also, hopefully by the end of today, there will be a ChristmasPerspective.com website. I've got the domain name. It's parked. It's waiting for me to add stuff to. So that's something that I've got to work on. Hopefully, that will be done today. And the same thing will happen there. As the episodes drop each day, they'll pop up on that website, and there'll be a little blurb about why it's being done. But that's the Christmas perspective. Okay. And I'm working on that. Actually, each day, I'm recording all of these chapters here in the Daily Perspective Podcast studio. I'm recording all of these chapters, and I've gotten into them a pretty good ways, but I've still got a ways to go. So my Thanksgiving partly will be spent recording chapters from the book of Luke. Oh, also a reminder, I won't be here either tomorrow or Friday, and no, I'm not going shopping on Black Friday. Yesterday was a full day. There was this podcast, as I said, the Christmas perspective recordings and the work on that. I had sessions, multiple, with at the Dawson Now Studios. We put together a really interesting podcast with a young man who's got more drive and get up and go and determination in his little finger than I do in my whole body, which explains why he's made it as far as he has. And I'm sitting here in my own little studio doing this pokey podcast and aside from the fact that I'm basically retired and this is what I do, but his name is Brylan Hollyhand, and he has a website called thetruthgazette.com. He has a podcast. He has talked with a lot of people, from Donald Trump Jr. to Sarah Huckabee Sanders to you think about it. You think of a name that's in current conservative media today, and he's probably talked to them and done interviews with them. He's a very productive guy. He's making me jealous, and he's 13 years old. That was what I did yesterday. And plus, we recorded an episode of his podcast as well, which is something I've got to edit and send back to him today. So it was a pretty busy day. What else? Oh yeah. So I get home to the studio, and I have maybe 20 minutes, and I'm dumping everything into my system to do the edit down for the Dawson Now podcast. And my wife gets home, and generally my wife, when Jane, the sweetest woman in the world, when she gets off work, she gets off work at a specific time in the afternoon, but she doesn't leave for an hour after that, at least, because she leaves her position and goes to help somebody else tidy up some things that they do every day. So she is a perfect example, a shining example of going above and beyond the call of duty and making yourself valuable to your employer, which is a lesson that the generations following us don't seem to understand. All they want to do is complain about their work conditions instead of improve their work conditions by taking it upon themselves to do so and making themselves valuable to their employers. Anyway, so she gets off at a specific time. I can usually count on an hour and a half after she gets off work. And so I'm sitting here anticipating that amount of time and looking at getting things handled. And she walks in the door. She gets here literally 30 minutes after she got off work, which meant that she just kind of tidied up and then left instead of hanging around, because we had to go hit the grocery store and pick up some stuff before the Thanksgiving crush hits. And that was what we did. We grabbed a quick bite to eat, and then we stopped off to pick up the stuff. And we do that. I don't know if you do this. Have you tried the Walmart ordering thing where if you shop for groceries at Walmart, you go online and you place your grocery order and you pay for it, and then you go, they send you a note to let you know your order's ready. You have a pickup window, a time to pick it up, and you go by and you give them a quick phone call and say, hey, I'm here, and you park out front and they bring your groceries to you. Holy cow, is this awesome? That's all I can say. It's amazing. Because we sit in the car and chat, and we get on social media and laugh about stuff, and look in the rearview mirror, and there comes somebody pushing a cart with all these blue totes on it, and you push the button to pop the rear hatch on the car, and they load it all in, and they go through whatever substitutions or things that they didn't have that you ordered, and you sign off on everything, and off you go. You just have to load it in at the house. It's just amazing. That way you don't have to walk the aisles and wonder why people decide to park their buggy on one side and then block the other side of the aisle with their body and things like that. Yeah, it's just amazing. But we did that, and it got back to into the studio and edited down the podcast that released today on Dawson Now. And including a typo, which I had to fix early this morning in the description. And then I finished up really late and then crashed. That's pretty much, that was my day yesterday. Did I bore you? I bored me. But that was it. It was a busy day. I really didn't have much downtime at all yesterday. And in my life, I've usually got a few hours of downtime during the day where I can decompress and just unplug. Not so much yesterday. And don't forget, Thanksgiving tomorrow, I said this already, and I have special audio in the last segment today about Thanksgiving. Before we go any further, I think it's important to remind ourselves that we, in most cases, we can't trust CNN to be honest with us. We just can't. Boy, did I just shift gears. Yeah. You remember CNN put out a poll in the last several days that says that even after the impeachment process, everything we've seen on TV and the farce that is the Democrats' impeachment process, the country is divided, that the statistics have not changed. That was their position. Now, every other reliable polling source says that things have shifted and that the nation's attitude and opinion towards impeachment is now negative. It is markedly negative. But CNN's poll says the nation is divided 50-50 on impeaching Trump. Do you know how they got that 50-50 number? They got that 50-50 number by surveying 6% more Democrats than they did Republicans. That's how they got that 50-50 survey number. When CNN starts talking about polling, when CNN starts talking about facts and figures, when they start talking about numbers, they are almost completely and totally without exception going to fudge those numbers away from Republicans and conservatives. They're going to favor Democrats, liberals, progressives. They are every time. And this is just the latest example. And that's one reason we really, really can't trust CNN to bring us the news. Now, accurately, I should say. Now, from time to time, they do somehow let things slip. For example, coming from DailyWire.com, Andrew Klavan reported on his show and wrote an article about the IG report. It's coming out. Now, this is the interesting thing because this entire impeachment charade has been to mask the malfeasance of the Obama administration, the scandal-free Obama administration, which, of course, spied on Donald Trump. So now there's a story that's come out. CNN broke the story. It was in the Wall Street Journal as well. And remember, Kimberly Strassel came on from the Wall Street Journal and was on with Andrew Klavan. He talked with him about the IG report and said not to think that it's going to be a big deal. It's supposed to come out in full on December 9th. And she said, paraphrasing, I don't think it's going to be a big deal. It's the Durham report from the DOJ that's the big deal. But here's from the Wall Street Journal. The Justice Department's Inspector General is expected to conclude there was a proper legal basis for the government's application to monitor a former Trump campaign foreign policy advisor. And here's Carter Page's take, but that errors and lapses in judgment were made during the process, according to people familiar with the matter. Usual sources say among the findings identified in the report is that an FBI lawyer altered an email related to the surveillance of a former Trump campaign advisor, people familiar with the matter said last Friday. The conduct didn't change the watchdog's overall conclusion. So in other words, they're saying the IG is going to say, no, it was right to monitor Carter Page, but somebody tinkered with the FISA warrant with the information on the FISA warrant. Now, first of all, there's so much about this that needs to be unpacked. The fact that it broke on CNN, which now has Andrew McCabe, he's a CNN commentator. They've got all these FBI commentators of the former general counsel, Andrew McCarthy at the National Review says. James Baker's a frequent CNN guest. And so these are the people spinning the IG report before it comes out, hoping to make it as unimportant as they possibly can. This is a deep state enterprise to make it seem that the FBI did nothing wrong. But first of all, the first thing you should remember is that Rod Rosenstein, back in June of last year, was before the House Judiciary Committee doing an oversight of the FBI. And Matt Gaetz had him on the ropes. He was saying, yeah, when you signed these FISA reports, did you even read them? Did anybody brief you on them? But Rod Rosenstein, he's trying to explain the process by which he approved these FISA warrants, said this. We sit down with a team of attorneys from the Department of Justice, all of whom review that, provide a briefing for us about what's in it. And I reviewed that one in some detail, and I can tell you, sir, that the information that's public about that doesn't match with my understanding of the one I signed. So in other words, He was told what was in the FISA warrant. He was briefed on it by guys like Peter Strzok and all the other FBI characters, and he signed off on it. Then he came in and he said, wait, that's not what you told me was in this report. And obviously what we're talking about is the fact that they used the Steele dossier, paid for by the Clinton campaign, as evidence that they should be able to spy on Donald Trump. Now, there's more to this, and I want to share it with you, so hang loose. It's coming up after the break. We'll finish what this is dug into. Not much further to go, but the thing is, CNN actually did a report on this and unwittingly unveiled the truth that there is deep state activity going on against Donald Trump. Little CCR, hey. Welcome back to The Daily Perspective. Mark Congleton here, your sometimes humble host. Wow, I'm really butchering this Andrew Klavan article, and I apologize for that, but I skimmed it and then just realized in the middle of it, this is actually, the article itself is pretty much just a verbatim transcript of a section of his show. And I'm thinking, wait a minute. At any rate, back to what he was saying here. He said that now what they're talking about. Hold on. All right, here we are. In other words, he was told that what was in the FISA warrant, he was briefed on it by guys like Peter Strzok, all those other FBI characters. He signed off on it, and he came in and said, wait, that's not what you told me was in this report. And obviously, what we're talking about is the fact that they used this Steele dossier, paid for by the Clinton campaign, as evidence that they should be able to spy on Donald Trump. Now, what they're talking about, and this is something that Adam Schiff does all the time, and you've heard him do it before, he keeps saying that Trump denies it was Russian interference in the election. That's not the case. Now, you've heard that. I know you've heard that, that Adam Schiff says that Trump is denying it was Russian interference. He keeps saying that when Trump says there was Ukrainian interference in the election, that means he's denying there was Russian interference in the election, and this is not so. There can be both Russian interference and Ukrainian interference, and according to Politico, the Democrats were working with the Ukrainians to get dirt on Donald Trump or to get things that were helpful to Hillary Clinton. So none of this is what Trump is saying. All Trump is saying is, I didn't do it. I'm not with the Russians. I'm not working with the Russians, which turned out, as we know from the Mueller report, it turns out to be absolutely true. That's why Trump keeps saying, hey, let's have a trial. He wants a trial in the Senate. He knows if he gets a trial in the Senate, that he's just going to waltz right back into the White House. Because in the trial in the Senate, the Republicans will actually be able to follow the rule of law instead of ignore the rule of law, as the Democrats have during their sham hearings. They'll be able to call witnesses. They'll be actually able to truly cross-examine Democrat witnesses and be able to get to the truth, the bottom of all of this stuff, as it has been reported to us. And we will learn what's really going on, and we will see the corruption and the depth of crime that's going on in the Democrat Party and in some areas of the Republican Party in the deep state. Now, I remind you, I don't have it handy right now, but I remind you that back about this time in 2016, or a little before it was in October of 2016, President Trump, then candidate Trump, made a speech. And he talked about the corruption in Washington, D.C. He talked about the deep state. He talked about how there is criminal activity going on behind the scenes. The people that we elect who go to Washington, D.C. and we reelect and reelect and reelect. And how they're actually not doing the job we hire them to do. And that it's time to clean the swamp and drain the swamp. He talked about that far back. And now, because of all of this unpleasantness, we're seeing this come to pass. And hopefully, we'll see some positive results come of it. Hopefully. Time to shift gears. We talked recently about Chick-fil-A and their decision to drop a couple, the Salvation Army and the Fellowship of Christian Athletes, in their charitable giving. And there's an article, a column, over at the Patriot Post by Mark Alexander. And it's a little lengthy. I'm going to try to get it all in for you before the break. But I think it's important because he has a good take on this. He says, there is a lot to admire about Chick-fil-A, but good, faithful people can make poor decisions. I was a Boy Scouts of America leader for almost 15 years. My two sons are Eagle Scouts, and for the last 10 years, I've served on the executive board of a historic council. It is with that background, for context, that I issue the following warning to our friends at Chick-fil-A. I have watched the National BSA's slow motion slide from one of the nation's leading character-building organizations for young men into the cultural abyss that inevitably follows the implementation of policies endeavoring to comport with the current gender devolution orthodoxy. I was struck this week by a comment from Russell Ballard, a leader of the Mormon Church and member of its quorum of the 12 Apostles. Ballard was explaining the upcoming divorce between the Boy Scouts of America, now the Scouts, and Scout units associated with the Mormon Church. Ballard claimed, quote, "The reality is we didn't really leave them. They kind of left us. The direction they were going was not consistent with what we feel our youth need to have to survive in the world that lies ahead for them," end quote. That statement is grossly inaccurate because in 2013, it was BSA President Wayne Perry, a Mormon, who led the charge to allow gender-confused youth, those who identify as gay, into the ranks of the Boy Scouts. Announcing that policy change in May of that year, Perry insisted that the resolution reaffirms our core belief in doing one's duty to God, but insisted the BSA would maintain the current membership policy for all adult leaders, prohibiting homosexual leaders. But Perry was also quick to note, some have voiced concerns that this proposal could put children at risk of being abused. The BSA makes no connection between sexual abuse and homosexuality. Ahead of that national BSA board decision, I wrote an open letter to an Eagle Scout, knowing that after so much effort to obtain that rank, this decision would be demoralizing to many Eagle Scouts. I also warned that opening this capitulatory door would lead to demands for homosexual adult leaders. Indeed, in July 2015, the BSA National Board changed their policy to allow homosexual leaders. I responded with a critical analysis of that terrible decision called the Boy Scouts Gay Pride Merit Badge. In 2017, the BSA National Board capitulated to the next demand, allowing so-called transgender youth. For the record, there is no such thing as transgender. Regardless of what self-mutilation one undertakes, genetically they will be the same gender from birth to death. But I digress. It is no small irony that last year the BSA announced it was facing the prospect of bankruptcy due to lawsuits in response to homosexual predation on boys. Given that BSA leaders had attempted to conceal information about these predators for decades, they have even mortgaged their own crown jewel, Philmont Scout Ranch, reportedly for a line of credit, to settle claims. In other words, the National BSA Board already knew there was a history of adult predators, but still implemented policies that would expose more boys to predation. Despite the fact that virtually all BSA sexual assaults have been homosexual, recall Perry's mindless assertion, quote, "The BSA makes no connection between sexual abuse and homosexuality," end quote. As a result of the absurd BSA policy changes from 2013 to 2018, scouting membership dropped from 2.7 million to 2 million. In January of next year, the BSA will lose an estimated 400,000 LDS youth members, bringing national membership down to 1.6 million. So what is the lesson here for Chick-fil-A and its recent policy changes regarding Christian organizations it supports? First, one reason the BSA capitulated to homosexuals is that the national board is populated with wealthy corporate types. They are fundraisers who also have to be concerned that their association with the BSA might cause a boycott of their corporations. Thus, it is a Faustian bargain to invite wealthy corporate types as board members and trustees. Thus, the board pressure behind these changes. But Chick-fil-A is a privately held company, and its board is controlled by CEO Dan Cathy, son of company founder Truett Cathy and his family. Thus, they do not have the same public corporate motive to abide by leftist social orthodoxies. The primary question for the Cathy family is one for balancing principles with profits. Second, I have met the Cathys and many folks with Chick-fil-A, and I know well the extraordinary support they have provided to faith-based groups over the decades. But they have been under assault by homosexual advocacy groups since 2012, when Dan Cathy made clear his position to same-sex marriage based on clear Christian principles. The recent decision to drop some Christian organizations from their support roster after their commitments expired was arguably based on the company's store expansion priorities and not wanting to meet homosexual resistance in those markets. Chick-fil-A president Tim Tosopoulos commented on those priorities as they related to dropping some Christian ministries. Quote, "There's no question we know that as we go into new markets, we need to be clear about who we are. There are lots of articles and newscasts about Chick-fil-A, and we thought we needed to be clear about our message." But the decision to make those changes originated with Rodney D. Bullard, Vice President of Corporate Social Responsibility for Chick-fil-A, which includes community affairs and environmental sustainability initiatives. Bullard is also Executive Director of Chick-fil-A Foundation, from where the company's $10 million in annual charitable donations are awarded. And there's more, which we'll get to following the break. And I do want to finish this because he has a very important thing to say to Chick-fil-A, a warning about how they're sliding down the same slippery slope the Boy Scouts of America has been sliding down and where that leads. That comes up after the break here on the Daily Perspective Podcast. We're back. Welcome to the Daily Perspective Podcast. Hi there. The day before Thanksgiving. I've been sitting here thinking about the Thanksgiving meal tomorrow. It's going to happen around, I guess, 2 in the afternoon for us. There'll be much, much, much more food than we can all possibly eat. And I will eat much, much more than I am actually comfortable with eating. Even if I justify it, hey, it's Thanksgiving. At some point, I'll sit back and shake my head and think, I really shouldn't have had that last helping. I really shouldn't have. But it's Thanksgiving, for Pete's sake. All the great foods, the desserts, the stuff you only get at the holidays. The way I look at it is the diet can just take a vacation. We'll get back to you in January. Oh, my. Let's get back to this this article that I was sharing with you by Mark Alexander over on Patriot Post. By the way, the stories that I'm talking about today, you can always find these stories in the show notes. I post them to social media, and they're on the website at dailyperspectivepodcast.com every day. At the end of the show, the links to the stories are all right there. So grab the show notes, because you probably want to go back through these. There are always links in the articles to other stories with references and the like, so you can chase those links down and find out a lot more information that I bring to you during the show. So you should grab the show notes and dig a little deeper, find out what's going on. All right, let's back up a bit and start over with this paragraph. But the decision to make those changes, talking about Chick-fil-A's policy changes as far as charitable giving goes, the decision to make those changes originated with Rodney D. Bullard, the Vice President of Corporate Social Responsibility for Chick-fil-A, which includes community affairs and environmental sustainability initiatives. Bullard is also Executive Director of Chick-fil-A Foundation, from where the company's $10 million in annual charitable donations are awarded. Bullard is an exceptional person. He grew up in Decatur, Georgia, the son of a minister and educator in a faithful household with limited means. He struggled to read at an early age, but overcame that struggle with the help of a teacher who took a special interest in his situation and tutored him. He says, quote, "If not for Mrs. Adams, I might have lost faith in myself and never realized the power of my ability to learn," end quote. Bullard is a model for that power and ability, coming a long way uphill since he learned to read. From modest beginnings, he earned an appointment to the Air Force Academy. After graduating from USAFA, he achieved loftier goals, including being selected to serve as a White House fellow under the Bush administration, Bush 43. He earned a law degree from Duke University and worked for the Department of Justice prior to being hired by Chick-fil-A. In a May interview, Bullard declared that Chick-fil-A Foundation was guided by a, quote, higher calling than any political or cultural war, end quote. But the political and cultural doors he has opened imply that higher calling is being unduly influenced by the political or cultural war. There is a lot to admire about Rodney Bullard, the Cathy family, and Chick-fil-A. This is a good opportunity run by a good company, I should say, run by good people who do a lot of good things for their employees, customers, and the communities they serve. But good people of faith can make poor decisions, and in my estimation, the recent decision to drop Christian organizations that support the timeless traditional definition of marriage and family hints at a trend toward placing profits over principles. Moreover, it may foretell a slide toward simultaneously being in the world and of the world, rather than in the world but not of the world. That is a faith and culture bridge that Truett Cathy would never have attempted to cross. All said, the primary lesson from the BSA for Chick-fil-A is this. Similar to the BSA, Chick-fil-A's corporate model and customer base have been built on a foundation of strong Christian principles. Devaluing those principles devalues their customer base, and opening the door to such devaluation has already invited more efforts to silence the principles upon which this good company was founded. And that is the article by Mark Alexander. And it's long, but it's accurate. It's truthful. And we have already seen that regardless of what Chick-fil-A's decision was, the people that they are trying to appease don't care. Already, we have seen the examples in social media from people who say, well, once they prove that they've conformed all their hiring practices to LGBTQ initiatives, once they offer special protections is what it boils down to, with all regards to the LGBTQ way of life or way of seeing the world around them. Unless that's all done, call us when you're done. And that's pretty much the attitude. They're not making any difference by doing this. By removing these charities, the Fellowship of Christian Athletes and the Salvation Army, from their charitable giving, all they're doing is opening the door for more people to shove their foot in and make more demands, rather than standing firm by their policy and maintaining their integrity. Chick-fil-A, in this sense, has made what I think is a major blunder. They know that they're going into markets and they're trying to cut back on the resistance going into those markets. We know from the stories in the news that some cities run by liberals, by leftist progressives, have decided to essentially censor Chick-fil-A and keep them out of their cities, airports, college campuses, and the like, all based on something that actually is a misinterpretation or a misrepresentation of the company itself. The company itself is not the founder. The company itself is a business. The company itself, as a business, is directed, is held to certain legal standards. And those legal standards prevent the company from discriminating against people. The same people who are pitching a hissy fit about the company. The company, Chick-fil-A, employs gay people. The company, Chick-fil-A, sells chicken to gay people. The company, Chick-fil-A, doesn't care. It doesn't discriminate. The founder of the company and the family have their views. They see the world through a certain lens. the company cannot discriminate against people because of those views, because the law does not allow them to. The company provides these same people who are objecting with opportunities to learn, to grow, to succeed. They have a management program. They have training. They have pathways to success for people who will set the unimportant aside and pursue things which will enrich their lives and their families. And sadly, what we have going on today in our society is that the LGBTQ community and the people, which, by the way, is really, really tiny. It is so small. It is such a tiny percentage of the U.S. population. That community and their much larger advocate group, those people who emotionally support the LGBTQ community because they have been convinced that the LGBTQ group is a victim class, which we're back to laws again. As far as the law is concerned, as far as the way everything is legally required to operate in America, they're not a victim group unless they portray themselves as a victim group. And time again, we have seen stories again and again and again and again about people who claim to be victims of certain activities and actions, violence and the like. And it's been fraudulent. But in America, these people, legally speaking, aren't a victim group. The only people who think they are a victim group are themselves, they themselves, and the politicians who will profit by playing off of their victim mentality. Chick-fil-A needs to understand that catering to this tiny, tiny, tiny group of people is like catering to that customer who is never happy with their order, constantly complains, writes letters to the management, fusses, but keeps coming back. And for some reason feels the need to keep coming back and making their lives miserable because they're never happy. And you ask anybody who's in business, anybody who manages or owns a business, and they can tell you stories, off the record, of course, but they can tell you stories about that customer. That customer who has decided it's their mission in life to make life a living hell for the ownership or the management of their business. And I know this because I have not been a business owner, except for my own private enterprise, but I have been into management. And I have dealt with the public, and I know how this works from personal experience, because there are those people who will continue to come to your restaurant, who will continue to come to your place of business and spend money with you and gripe about everything. And sadly, what Chick-fil-A has done is they have kicked open the door to a group of people who will never, ever, ever be happy with them, who have, for the past 7 years, harbored a hatred based on the views of one man. They have harbored a hatred for a large corporation based on the views of a single person. That's not mentally healthy, but that's the crowd you're dealing with when you're dealing with the people who are anti-Chick-fil-A. The LGBTQ community is pretty tiny. They have a pretty vocal advocacy group who are leftist progressives. And their advocacy is all based on emotion. But when it really comes down to things, they will never be happy unless the rainbow flag flies over every Chick-fil-A location and every employee is a member of the LGBTQ. This is The Daily Perspective. It's the Thanksgiving edition of the show. Tomorrow is Thanksgiving Day. Black Friday follows that. I won't be here either day. Sorry. Taking a four-day weekend. Looking forward to tomorrow, though, I gotta tell you. I don't know if you saw the news, but President Donald Trump yesterday used the high power of his office to pardon Butter, a 47-pound turkey, during a U.S. tradition at the White House, where he also cracked jokes about Democrats' investigation into whether he should be impeached. Both Butter and his alternate, Bread, escaped the fate of becoming the main course of a Thanksgiving feast and were sent to a special reserve in Virginia. Kids, they went to live on a farm. Standing at a podium in the Rose Garden, Trump said the birds had been raised to remain calm under any condition. Quote, which will be very important because they've already received subpoenas to appear in Adam Schiff's basement on Thursday. He was joking, referring to the House of Representatives Intelligence Committee chairman who has led the inquiry into whether Trump should be impeached for pressing Ukraine to investigate a political rival of his. He went on to say, it seems the Democrats are accusing me of being too soft on turkey. But Bread and Butter, I should note that, unlike previous witnesses, you and I have actually met. While other presidents occasionally gave turkeys commutations starting with Abraham Lincoln, another Republican president, George H.W. Bush, was the first to make sparing one an official act. That's according to the nonprofit Constitution Center. Trump's predecessor, Democrat Barack Obama, is credited with starting the tradition of cracking dad jokes at the pardon. The threat of impeachment may be looming larger each day, with Democrats expected to release a crucial report after Thanksgiving, but it didn't stop the White House from reveling this week in the somewhat goofy pardoning tradition. It posted videos of the turkeys checking into a special suite at the Willard Hotel, where political leaders have stayed in the past, and baseball card-like statistics on both Bread and Butter. The National Turkey Federation introduced the birds in a press conference on Tuesday. In true Washington fashion, polling decided which turkey would receive the official pardon, with Americans sharing their preference for Butter on Twitter. According to the White House, Butter enjoys listening to bagpipes and has a gobble style that is rowdy. Bread prefers bluegrass music and wants to master aerial yoga. You know, it's a goofy tradition. It really is a goofy tradition, pardoning the turkey for Thanksgiving. It really is. But don't you think we need that? We need that little bit of levity, that little bit of fun? I think we do. Now, back to Thanksgiving. What's it all about? Well, thanks to PragerU, here's the story.
Food, football, and oppression. That's what Thanksgiving has come to mean to many Americans. Back in 2007, Seattle public school officials made national news by describing the holiday as a time of mourning and a bitter reminder of 500 years of betrayal. This new narrative describes the pilgrims as arrogant oppressors who fled persecution only to become persecutors themselves, depriving Native Americans of their land and their lives. But this is wrong on every count. First of all, the pilgrims didn't cross the ocean to flee persecution or even England. They'd been living for over a decade in Holland, Europe's most tolerant nation and a haven for religious dissenters. Free from interference by the Church of England, they feared seduction, not persecution, worrying that their children would be corrupted by the materialistic Dutch culture. That's why they risked their dangerous 1620 voyage to a wilderness continent, not because they were running from oppression, but because they were running toward holiness, fulfilling a fateful mission to build an ideal Christian commonwealth. They initially planned to plant this model society on the wild, wolf-infested island known to natives as Manhattan. But winds and tides blew them 250 miles off course, dumping the Mayflower on the frozen coast of Massachusetts. Somehow, the pilgrims saw their dire situation as a demonstration of providential power, especially after a giant wave picked up the flimsy boat of a scouting party on a stormy December night. The turbulent sea then deposited them safely, miraculously, on a little island within sight of the ideal location for their settlement. It was a deserted Indian village with cleared land, stored supplies of corn, and a reliable source of fresh water. No, these supposedly cruel conquerors never actually invaded that village. Instead, they expressed a fervent desire to pay the natives for the dried corn they found, if only they could find someone to pay. But the former inhabitants had perished during 3 years of plague, probably smallpox, that immediately preceded the pilgrims' arrival. One of the few survivors of that devastation turned up several months later to welcome the English newcomers. Against all odds, he proved to be the single human being on the continent best suited to help the struggling settlers, since he spoke English and had already embraced Christianity. His name was Squanto, and he had grown up in this very village before a ruthless sea captain kidnapped him as a boy and sold him into slavery in Spain. After 4 years, he was freed by kindly monks, then made his way to England, and finally sailed across the Atlantic, only to find his friends and family all wiped out by disease. Over the next few months, Squanto helped the English newcomers plant crops and negotiate a friendly trade agreement with the region's most important chief, Massasoit. No wonder Pilgrim leader William Bradford called Squanto a special instrument sent of God for their good. The celebration, later known as the First Thanksgiving, actually involved a three-day harvest festival in October, apparently inspired by the biblical holiday of Sukkot, or the Feast of Tabernacles. 90 hungry Indian warriors joined the 53 surviving pilgrims for this occasion. Nearly half of the colonists had died during the brutal winter. The Englishmen provided some vegetables, fish, and perhaps wild turkeys, while the natives brought 5 recently hunted deer as house gifts. The preferred sport on this occasion wasn't football, but shooting, with settlers and Indians sharing a fierce fascination with guns. Though these hardy pilgrims loom large in the American imagination, they never built their Plymouth settlement into a major colony. And nearby Boston, the later colony of Massachusetts Bay grew so much faster that it swallowed up the great-grandchildren of the pilgrims in 1691. But the sense of purpose of the original pilgrims left a permanent imprint on the national character. They maintained unshakable confidence that God protected them, not to grant special privileges, but to impose special responsibilities. They saw themselves as instruments, not authors, of a mysterious master plan. Today, with our continued blessings so obvious and so overwhelming, the only reason to treat this beloved national holiday as a time of mourning is that some foolish Americans actually think that's a good idea. The pilgrims knew better. They understood that people of every culture and every era can gain more from gratitude than from guilt. I'm Michael Medved for Prager University.
We can gain more from gratitude than guilt. How true. Thanks to Michael Medved and Prager U. And hopefully tomorrow will be a grateful day for you and yours. I'm going to try to make it that way for us. God bless you. Have a great Thanksgiving. We'll see you back here on the Monday edition of The Daily Perspective. Bye-bye.
Oh, we're done.